Good morning, everyone. Talk Radio 930 WTAD. Glad to be here. Mary Griffith. My guest on the phone today is Brent Engel. Brent is an award-winning journalist and a public relations professional. He lives in Louisiana, Missouri. He grew up in Augusta, Illinois, and he has written a book about a variety of topics in Pike County, Illinois, and we're going to talk about that book today. Good morning, Brent Engel.
Good morning. It's Pike County, Missouri, actually, that we're talking about.
Oh, did I say Illinois?
But I got some stories from Pike County, Illinois, too.
I was going to say, I accidentally said Illinois. You grew up in Augusta, Illinois. Have you ever done anything about Augusta's history?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I'm doing it right now, and I'm hoping to put together my next book about Augusta and some of its stories from the past. And some of them are pretty crazy. We had a woman who was... who could be said had pain in her heart, revenge on her mind, and dynamite in her hands. So I'll let sit there and go out, and hopefully people will pick that book up when it comes out later this year or early next.
Pain in her heart, revenge on her mind, and dynamite in her hand. Are you sure you didn't miss your calling to work for the National Enquirer?
Well, if they call, sure, why not?
Why not?
That's a great way to promo it anyway, because how many crazy ladies can you say that about?
No, not too many. Maybe me, and maybe this just this other lady in Augusta. That's all I can think of. So this is history is a passion of yours. You've been on the show several times talking about different political figures in history from Louisiana and from Bowling Green. But this book is not just about political figures. It's a tale about a lot of different people and subjects in Pike County, Missouri, and it's called Just One More Thing. One More Thing, and I guess that's the tagline for a lot of things. As a straight journalist, you went out and got the story all the time when you worked in television and newspaper and radio work. But you always, since I know you pretty well, Brent, you always were looking for, okay, that's what happened, but the why, what's behind this? And these things.
Sometimes
yeah.
It's not only the who, what, where, when, why, and how, it's the huh? What the heck happened there? That's kind of what got me interested in history. My father was a social studies and history teacher, my mother an English teacher, so I always did well in those subjects. I had to find a calling in that because there was no way I could do math and science. So they were bad at it, and I was bad at it, and my son, fortunately, is good at it now, but that may change the angle math and science gene may kick in. But I was always interested in history, and when I moved from Quincy to Pike County to Louisiana, I saw a sign that said John Henderson, John B. Henderson, Riverview Park. And I thought to myself, well, who is this guy? Who is John Brooks Henderson? I've never heard of him. He's the guy who co-wrote and introduced the 13th Amendment outlawing slavery. Pretty important dude in history, I would think. And I hadn't heard much about him. I figured, well, maybe other people haven't. So I wrote a book about him 3 years ago that explained what he did and some of the really remarkable things he was involved with in just 7 years in the U.S. Senate. And then beyond that, he was also involved in a lot of national issues. And so there is a story about John B. in the book, the new book, One More Thing. But as you said, most of the stories have to deal with a variety of topics. There's everything from murder and mayhem to sin and sports. So, I mean, you got a wide variety of topics there. There are 25 stories altogether, plus a few short bits at the end that are rather humorous.
Now, getting back to John Brooks Henderson, one of the things that we talked about a couple of years ago when you were just releasing that book, that was when the movie about Abraham Lincoln starring Daniel Day-Lewis was coming out. And the Tommy Lee Jones character kind of stole all the thunder. John Brooks Henderson wasn't really a part of that movie because he was in the House, right? And they centered on the Senate in the movie depiction. Is that correct?
No, it's just the opposite.
Okay.
They centered on the House. They centered on Thaddeus Stevens, who was in the House.
Okay.
Who was an incredibly a strong abolitionist. So that was good. But, yeah, they didn't do anything about the Senate, where the amendment was first introduced and where it was approved first before it went to the House.
Now, were you disappointed?
That was part of the problem.
Yeah. Were you disappointed in that? I mean, here was a big chance, really, for John Brooks Henderson to get some due and for people to know who he was. You know, I bet you a lot of people who don't know anything about American history, right after that movie, if you said Thaddeus Stevens, they would have at least known one or two things about him. So it's too bad that Steven Spielberg went the way of just kind of ignoring the house. But I guess that happens.
That's the way it goes. I mean, and I wrote to Mr. Spielberg and explained to him about his errors in not including Henderson in the movie. Also invited him to come see a play I wrote about Henderson. I never heard from him, but that's okay. You know, I don't mind. You know, at some point he will finally realize his mistake and make up for it, I'm sure.
Well, wouldn't that be great? We could have a premiere right there in Louisiana, Missouri, of the John Brooks Henderson story directed by Steven Spielberg and perhaps starring as the narrator, Mr. Brent Engel. That would be fantastic. Brent, you've always been so fascinated, like you said, and so interested in history. So one of the things, you've got 25 stories in this book. You probably have 2,500 stories in your head. Put me in the position of being a writer. When you're doing one more thing, how do you cull the herd from all the really, everybody's got an anecdote, down to 25 stories that you can write efficiently and effectively and evoke some, you know, drama and emotion from?
Well, it all starts with the research. Once you do the research, you get in your mind how the story is going to come together, because obviously history is in black and white. There are very few gray areas. I mean, what's printed or written is what you have to go with. You don't have anything else. You can't go with supposition or somebody said this or somebody said that. It's got to be what's written down somewhere. And you take a variety of sources and compare them to see if the stories all match. And when the stories match, that's when you start writing. And it's a very long process, but it's very intriguing because you get to know a lot more about your subjects by doing so. You know, when I was researching this book, and in fact, in the book on Augusta I'm researching now, I'm finding out a lot of stuff that I didn't know before. And, you know, I was a townie. I was an Augusta resident for 18 years. So I know I should have known a little bit more about it than I did. And so by doing the research, that helps immensely. One of the great things about doing research now that historians didn't have in the past, say 50 or more years ago, is the Internet. I mean, it helps immensely in locating documents and going on to historic sites, the Library of Congress. The Quincy Public Library has been immensely helpful.
Oh, yeah.
Great stuff.
Yeah, that Quincy Public Library has that genealogy room, and of course they've got every copy of the old Whig and now the Herald Whig and the old Herald, and, you know, it's great. That brings up the next question, which is, in this Twitterverse that we live in now, this Snapchat, this tweeting, I'm concerned, where will the repository be? Because obviously we still have the printed page. And you always have your hometown newspaper, and then I guess the New York Times and the Washington Post, kind of the paper of record of what happened in the world today. But are you concerned that we're losing? I mean, who's going to go back and examine, for example, someone like Donald Trump? Now, Donald Trump could be the next president of the United States. So historians will be extraordinarily interested in his life prior to stepping forward into the political realm. But where will they really get that information? Because will they go and review old apprentice shows? Will they get his Twitter account and get a copy of everything? I mean, so much of Donald Trump's life and why we know him has nothing to do with a journalist sitting down and interviewing him.
You're hitting the nail on the head, as always. It's remarkable to think about, and it's scary to think about, too. I'll pass on three words that have been handed down to me by other historians and that I will hand down to everyone I know. Those three words are write it down. One of the biggest complaints, I guess, I have about John Brooks Henderson is that he wrote hardly anything down. The only thing I have to go on in doing the continued research I do on him, I write monthly stories about John Brooks Henderson and his exploits. The only thing I have to go on is the congressional record and maybe a few letters and maybe a few newspaper stories that were done. And there aren't many quotes in those stories. So the actual words that he spoke mainly come from his speeches on the Senate floor. And he didn't always talk about the issue at hand. There are long stretches in the congressional record. It was called the Congressional Globe back then, that where he doesn't say anything about any subject. So it's you need to write stuff down, and we're generally losing a lot of that with the internet.
I'm reminded of Ted Cruz reading The Cat in the Hat and Green Eggs and Ham one time when he was trying to, I guess, filibuster, and he had the floor, and he wasn't going to give up the floor, so he was reading Dr. Seuss books. So when people go back, you know, historians go back, they have to understand why Ted Cruz was reading The Cat in the Hat, why Ted Cruz was reading Green Eggs and Ham. And sometimes, if that's not clearly delineated by some other person speaking, you know, why are you trying to subrogate this bill or something? It can get lost. And so I'm very fascinated by what, you know, who knows, the Trump Presidential Library, what will be in there? You know, what will be in there? Will there be these tweets? Will there be, the copies of the show, the videos of the show? It's fascinating because, of course, as a mogul, he had much written about him in the business world. And he was probably on page six a lot and went to the Met Gala, and everybody commented on what, you know, his wife wore and what he wore. But the substance of the man, who has taken any time or effort before he announced he was running for president to really look into that? Probably very few people.
Sure. Who's saving those tweets? Who's saving those emails? I mean, you know, maybe the federal government is, and we just don't know it. but I mean, and what value will they have? Because, you know, you're talking about using a language that's very, very scarce in a way. I mean, you use symbols and letters that mean words, and how are people going to decipher that exactly? Unfortunately, it's becoming all too common, and even people who will go down in history are doing it too much. Instead of writing it down, they're texting it. Well, that doesn't work. That's not going to be a permanent record. So I would urge people, again, write it down. If you've got those family histories, write them down. Make sure that they are in print somewhere. My family has done that, and I'm very proud of it. The Engel Farm up near Peoria, Illinois, where my father grew up, has been in the family now for more than 180 years. And my aunt has written down a lot of the family history. And so we have that. We know who we were and where we came from. So please do that. Don't hesitate. Start now.
Yeah, I guess if you could just put one word to Donald Trump, that word would be huge. But taken out of context, we won't know what it means. Let's talk about, you mentioned when you're trying to do James Brooks Henderson, you have the problem where the man was very, I mean, he was a prominent figure in American history, but he didn't speak a lot where anybody recorded his words. You have to fill in the gaps. Talk about maybe one of the stories that you've written in One More Thing, A History of Pike County, Missouri. One of the stories where I know you don't want it to be a work of fiction, but did you have to kind of fill in the gap with some kind of best guess as to what was happening? Because there's no way you knew all these people and maybe couldn't even interview people who ever talked to these people. So how did you do that research, and what was the toughest nut to crack?
Well, one of the stories that's in there is about John Brooks Henderson, and it happens to be on April 14, 1865, which is, of course, a prominent date in American history. John Brooks Henderson visited the White House on that day. We know that. But whether he was the last person to speak to Lincoln before Lincoln and his wife left for Ford's Theater, we're not sure about. And I present the pros and cons. He was there ostensibly to win the freedom for a Confederate spy from Canton, Missouri. And he got what he wanted eventually, but he had to come back to the White House a couple of times. And he was a good friend of Lincoln's because he and Lincoln had worked on a lot of things in the 3 years that Henderson was in Washington. But trying to flush that out between what was the true story and what may have been in somebody's imagination or somebody's best guess about something was hard to do because the record doesn't indicate either way. And so I present both the pros and the cons of whether Henderson was actually at the White House that day to win the freedom of this Confederate spy from Canton or whether he was just there to visit with Lincoln.
Yeah, it's interesting. Maybe he was there to say, I saw an American cousin. It's not that great, Abe. Why don't you just skip the theater tonight and stay here and play cards with me? Now, that would be a great story.
That would have been fantastic, and we still would have had Lincoln around, of course, too. So, yes, that would have been amazing. But there are other stories in the book, too, that, you know, are first-person accounts. I talked to some World War II veterans in Clarksville who had different roles in the war. You know, one saw the horror of the Holocaust. A second helped the Germans rebuild. Another provided comfort when another enemy moved in. That was the Soviets when they blockaded Berlin. There was a fourth who spent the entire war on American soil, but he was training a lot of guys who would never, you know, set foot on it again. He
right.
was training naval aviators. So, and there was a fifth who was getting ready for the invasion of Japan. As it turned out, of course, he didn't have to go because Harry Truman decided to drop the atomic bombs. There's a story about the atomic bombs in the book because a Bowling Green native was in charge of making sure that the atomic bomb project got off the ground. He was part of the Military Policy Committee, which oversaw the atomic bomb project. And in fact, he was sent to Tinian Island in the Pacific where the two planes took off to drop those bombs. So he was very instrumental in making sure that the atomic bomb project took off, and he was a Bowling Green native. That was Navy Rear Admiral William Reynolds Purnell.
You know, so
lots
yeah.
of stuff
wow.
in the book.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that somebody is talking to these World War II veterans, and then they need to talk to the Korean veterans and the Vietnam veterans. We've got to get these stories down. And, of course, we all know the Enola Gay, named for a Quincy mother, because Paul Tibbetts
you
was
bet.
Piloting. It's so amazing when you think of a little bitty, you know, Louisiana, Missouri, about town of about 5,000, Pike County, Bowling Green, Missouri, what, about 2,500 maybe? Something
well,
like
Bowling Green has about 5,000, but that includes the prisoners at the men's correctional facility. Louisiana has about 3,500, 4,000. So,
yeah,
just a small area. You know, total population of Pike County, right around 18,000. So, I mean, not a big total, you know, less than half of Quincy.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I think the population has gone down, obviously, in the last 50 years, but it still is fascinating that all you have to do is have a Brent Engel in every county or every community, and somebody who's really inspired. And one of the things that annoys me personally is growing up in Quincy here, and I probably was one of the kids that didn't know the answer to these questions, so I'm not disparaging the youth of today because I think I was pretty ignorant. They don't know who John Wood is. They don't know who Thomas Baldwin is. We have mansions and schools named after him. We have, you know, but they don't know who these people are. They don't know who Barry Ann is. I didn't know who Barry Ann was until about 10 years ago. I'm like, he wasn't a president, obviously. Who is this guy? It was just a local guy who donated the money to build Barry Ann School. Well, okay. Why isn't that taught? Why isn't that better known? Why don't local people know their own history? You were one of them. You grew up in Augusta. Of course, you're a teenager. Who cares? I mean, that's what I chalk it up to. A lot of people, you know, they really don't care about history till they're about to become history themselves. But why
that's
is...
That's a good way to put it. You're right, though. And unfortunately, that's the case. I mean, I think we need to get better. I know I don't want to put this... everybody ladles all the problems of America on education, but... I think one of the things we need to do is refocus a little bit on history and get away from all the dates and all the big stuff. Yeah, that's important. You have to know about the Constitution. I'm not saying dump the Constitution. I'm a strict constitutionalist, and so is John Brooks Henderson. But I'm saying that a little bit more needs to be paid attention to the local history and what's happening there. I mean, In the book, I write a story about Claude Gillingwater. I've never heard of Claude Gillingwater. Who is this guy? I ran across it doing some research for another story. He was one of 35 people who were in a room in Hollywood back in the mid-20s when Louis B. Mayer said, hey, let's start the Academy Awards. And so he was one of the founders of the Academy Awards, and he was from Louisiana, Missouri. I mean, you know, great stuff.
That is great stuff. And every year right before the Academy Awards, you always jog my memory by sending me an email about that. And guess what? And I don't think I have the picture anymore but I have a picture. My father's first wife was a filmmaker, and she lived extensively in Cuba and other places. And I have a picture of my dad and his first wife, who was a Quincy girl, at the Academy Awards.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But I don't know if I can put my fingers on it, because I will tell you this. Once you realize you're never going to have children, you start throwing everything away if you have to move, because you don't want to take it. So my brother, I may have given this to my brother, like, it's your turn to find a closet for this stuff. But it was very fascinating because, you know, of course, and this is another great thing about most family histories, there are remarriages, there are divorces, there are stepchildren, there are all these things that happen. And as the child, you know, of course, I didn't even think, you know, even until my dad turned 70, I never even really bothered to ask him, you know, did you have any life? Did you do anything before I was born, Dad? Or was you just waiting around for, you know, the birth of your first child? And everybody has a fascinating story to tell if you'll just sit down and give them the time and the prompting to tell it. And so this treasure trove of pictures, which, of course, why would my father, when I'm 14 years old, trot out a picture of, this is me and my first wife, you know? But it was fascinating. And now that I learned from you the connection to Louisiana, Missouri, I imagine that one of the reasons my dad was there was not just because his wife was a filmmaker, but because he knew those people. It's fascinating
well, sure.
to
and
think
he
about
probably
that.
Knew, he probably knew Cam and Gloria Hardin, who are from Louisiana. And you talked earlier about, what's the relevance of history? Here's one important aspect that shows you how history is still affecting people today. Cam and Gloria Hardin were from Louisiana, Cam was. He met Gloria in Hollywood. They got married. She was a New York girl. But they moved back to Louisiana at the height of their careers. They left Hollywood to come back and live and work in Louisiana, Missouri. And when they passed, they left, you know, they were childless. They left their estate, part of their estate, to cover scholarships for Louisiana high school students that are still being given today. They'll be given that in the next couple of weeks. The Cam and Gloria Hardin scholarship will be given to a student at Louisiana High School who's graduating to continue their education. So more than 25 years after their deaths, they're still having an impact on people today.